Calling All Brooklyn Moms, JOMA presents an evening of nutrition for moms and kids. On May 22nd at 8 p.m., learn helpful tips and tricks for preparing nutritious food for you and your family with Dr. Marina Klotzman and JOMA's Wellness Director, Julie Wilcox. The cost is $18 and the address will be provided upon registration. Register on our website, www.joma.org. We look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome to the JOMA podcast, presented by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. Every week, hear from expert medical professionals as they share up-to-date insights on health topics to help you live your best life physically, mentally, and emotionally. Join us as we navigate the ever-changing landscape of healthcare and strive to improve the health of the Orthodox Jewish community. Welcome to the JOMA podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jenny Berkovich, board-certified pediatrician and director of education for JOMA. My guest today is Dr. Alexandra Dubinskaya, and we talk all about female pelvic floor health, mostly chatted about urinary incontinence and all sorts of changes that pelvic floors undergo during our lifetime. So a very, very cool conversation, but definitely a little bit more mature content. Dr. Alexandra Dubinskaya actually founded the Los Angeles Institute for Pelvic and Sexual Health in Beverly Hills. Her institute offers specialized care for a range of women's health issues, from urinary incontinence to sexual dysfunction. She has expertise in urogynecology, reconstructive surgery, and sexual health. She is committed to providing holistic care that emphasizes women's wellness. She originally trained actually as a surgeon in Russia and then completed her training here in the United States in Tufts Medical Center in Boston and St. Francis Hospital in Hartford. She did her fellowship in female pelvic medicine at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Beverly Hills. She is globally recognized and chairs the Communication Committee for the International Society of Sexual Medicine, advocating for women's intimate health wellness. She has contributed extensively to academic literature, including publications in prominent journals and textbooks like Ostergaard's Urogynecology and Steele's Colorectal Textbook. She has also authored chapters on vulvodynia in various medical journals.
Hi, Dr. Dubinskaya, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So you have a fascinating specialty that I really don't know all that much about. So I'm excited to learn more. So maybe let's just start there. You're trained as a gynecologist initially, right? And then you have additional training on top of that. So maybe just orient me a little bit about how one even becomes a specialist like yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, urogynecology is a very unique field. It puts together gynecology and urology and treats condition that happens with our pelvic floor. Any urinary incontinence, pelvic organ prolapse, urinary tract infections, pain in your bladder, that's what we treat. And you can become a urogynecologist from the GYN world, or you can become a urogynecologist from urology world, just doing additional fellowship training.
Why was this an interesting field for you to specialize in? I'm guessing most people don't go into OB training thinking that this is something that they're going to end up doing.
Yes. Well, my journey is a little bit different. My journey started in Russia, where I did a medical school and general surgery residency. And I went into medicine because I wanted to make a difference. And when I completed my training, I wanted to learn from the best. And in my mind, the best was in United States. So I moved to the United States and had to repeat my training, confirm my diploma, and learn English. And then I really wanted to be in the women's health area to help women. And before getting into the residency, I was working for the urogynecologist. And I think that was the first time I was exposed to that field. And I met a lot of women who would just put everything that was on their mind on that was bothering them on me when I was a little medical assistant. And I thought maybe they're doing it because I have an accent, so they don't feel threatened by me. But then I realized that they're doing it because I was just willing to listen. And I was going to OBGYN residency with the goal to become a physician who specializes in pelvic health and sexual health, because for me, those two issues go so like close hand in hand together. And when I went to OBGYN residency, I was a little bit disappointed in how much time you have to spend in doing obstetrics, which was not my passion. And I added urogynecology training that was amazing. And I also had the opportunity to specialize in sexual medicine so I can provide treatment for multiple conditions. And I think those problems that women facing, it's not a respected problem. Like nobody going to talk about them at like a cocktail party. It's okay to talk about you had like a triple bypass surgery because it's a respected condition. But if you're peeing yourself anytime you cough or trying to exercise, like nobody going to like give that information away. So, but the surgeries that I do change women's life for better. And I think that's very rewarding for me. And it's very important to have more specialists who's doing urogynecology.
That's really amazing. It sounds extremely rewarding. I think when people, you're right, there's like probably, you know, a tremendous amount of stigma and maybe even shame around these things, which there absolutely should not be, right? These are conditions that are organic and physiologic and sort of natural part of women's lives. I think when I hear pelvic floor or anything related to urogyn, the only thing I can think of initially is issues related to pregnancy, right? Or issues as a consequence of pregnancy, but that's probably very limiting. So tell me a little bit about like, really what happens to the pelvic floor or maybe like common pelvic health issues that evolve over time, because I'm sure it's not just during the window of reproductive years.
Of course. Yes. So even for women who never been pregnant or had kids, they at risk of having pelvic floor dysfunction when the muscles are not functioning properly. And often it happens because we, as a women, we love carrying out stress on our pelvic floor. So similar how we like shrug our shoulders when we go into cold weather and we form this like painful, like muscle knots, and we need to go to like massage therapist to help us. Same thing happen in the pelvic floor. And because muscles, they support the organs, bladder, vagina, rectum, and they're not functioning properly, women start developing issues with frequent urination, always feeling like they need to go pee, pain with sex, pain with defecation, or inability to have a normal bowel movements. So it's very common. And what happens is women having those conditions, they start Googling it and they find Kegels. And they start doing Kegels every single day. And Kegels sometimes make those conditions worse because the muscles are already overworked and you make them work even harder. So, and it might not help the issue and actually make it worse. So it's very important to actually get the proper evaluation to determine, do you really need to do Kegels or do you need to learn how to relax those muscles?
That's very interesting. I feel like people's instinct, you're right, is to like obviously Google stuff and maybe read stuff about pelvic floor therapy or pelvic floor PT. But I've talked to a lot of people who feel even nervous, like initiating that first step, even like seeing pelvic floor PT, because they've heard that it's either like very invasive or it's an uncomfortable evaluation. What does that actually look like? How do you examine your patients?
Yeah, well, in my practice, I actually look for outside tissue because a lot of condition on the pelvic floor and the muscular component originate from outside. So if there is a skin changes that contribute to painful sex, I know that pelvic floor will react to it, will try to protect from anything that might happen. So I look outside, I assess the skin, the integrity, the color is also very important because vaginal opening, the vaginal tissue, as we get older, or let's say in postpartum period when women breastfeeding, they can change the color because of the deprivation of the lack of the hormones. So, and it will affect not only tissue, it also will affect the pelvic floor muscles as well. And it will affect the function of the bladder and our ability to have sex. So I looked at the tissue, I look at the urethra, because the way how urethra appears can tell me a lot about the hormonal state of the woman. I assess for the pelvic organ prolapse, if there is a bladder that's falling into the vagina, if the uterus start falling down, or sometimes the posterior wall of the vagina, kind of like the on the side of the rectum, start bulging in, which is very common after vaginal birth. So I assess for all of that. And then I do the manual examination where I feel and palpate all the muscles of the pelvic floor, trying to find those painful muscles, and also see if the patient can had like a spasms of the muscles. So if any of that is positive, it's definitely like I refer them to the pelvic floor physical therapy, who will do, which we call hands-on pelvic floor physical therapy, which means they will put their hand in the vagina and they will massage those muscles, because there is no any other way around it. I mean, men who go to pelvic floor physical therapy, they do it through the rectum. So whichever access point we have, that's how you get to those muscles, because there is no other way around.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, where you said sometimes issues with the pelvic floor can start even in women who have never been pregnant or haven't gone through childbirth. How would that manifest? Is it still the same way where they're maybe having a component of incontinence or discomfort or pain with sex, or other kind of like red flags that people can think about?
Absolutely, yes. So frequently going to the bathroom, they can develop overreactive bladder. And I know we usually think about overreactive bladder as a condition of the older people, but a lot of young people have overactive bladder, and they might have a lot of urgency and frequency during the day, and then they can sleep through the night. So there is also like a large component of emotional, like anxiety driven voiding. Also, they might feel like anytime they're trying to have a bowel movement, they have pain, or they're trying to have sex and it's just not working, or they have pain on initial penetration, and some people might have a pain on the deep penetration. Everything that's causing pain, or you start being aware of what's going on down below, I think that's a sign of like, oh, maybe I need to check it out. And if it happens once in a while, I mean, all of us go through that like once in a while, but if it's consistent enough for you to notice and pay attention, I think it's time to get evaluated.
Are there any risk factors that set somebody up for having these issues, whether it's before, as a consequence of childbirth, or unrelated?
Yeah, well, there is what we call non-modifiable factors. For example, our collagen, our quality of skin, similar how some women have zero wrinkles and some women have tons of wrinkles. Similar with the prolapse, some people just predisposed to have a weaker tissue, and they might develop prolapse later in life or develop urinary incontinence later in life. Pregnancy and childbirth, it's I don't consider it as a modifiable factors, because a lot of people want to have kids and there is very difficult to go around it. And pregnancy itself, because it puts so much pressure on your pelvis, carries increase the risk of developing pelvic floor disorders, and also having a vaginal birth, because during the vaginal birth, as the baby goes through the vaginal canal, it does create damage to the muscles, to the ligaments. The good thing, we women tend to recover from it, but the problem is that the damage that's done still affects how our muscles are functioning. And it's very important to do pelvic floor physical therapy after giving birth. And also, you might develop pelvic floor disorder later in life because you had a vaginal birth. So another factors that modifiable are maintaining a healthy weight, because if you have obesity, a lot of adipose tissue on your stomach, it will increase the abdominal pressure. It will predispose you to having those disorders. Chronic conditions like cough or chronic constipation, when you're always like pushing, spending a lot of time on the toilet, will increase the likelihood of developing those conditions. And smoking, because it also affects the quality of tissue.
That's interesting. So certainly some of those we have control over and some of them we don't. I'm curious because I think something that keeps coming up that you're mentioning is urinary incontinence, right? So I sort of remember a little bit from med school that it's not all the same, right? So there's different types. Walk me through that and then maybe briefly tell us like some available treatments, because I think people just like assume that surgery is the answer. And I'm sure that's at this point, not the case.
Yeah, so there are two major types of incontinence. One is urinary urge incontinence or overactive bladder incontinence, and another one is a stress urinary incontinence. So the easier way to understand that is imagine two muscles. One muscle is the bladder muscles, the detrusor muscles that contract when we're trying to pee. And another group of muscles is our pelvic floor that prevents the urine from coming out, kind of closing the urethra. So the normal case scenario, when we accumulating urine, we don't want to go to the bathroom, our pelvic floor muscles are contracted, keeping the bladder closed, and the bladder muscles are relaxed, accumulating the urine in the bladder. When it's time to go to the bathroom to pee, those bladder muscles start contracting, sending the stimuli to our brain that, hey, it's time to look for the bathroom. So when we find a good time to and good place to pee, our pelvic floor muscle relaxes and the bladder muscles contract to expel the urine. That's the normal case scenario. So what happens when you have a urinary urgency or urinary urge incontinence? Those bladder muscles contract uncontrollably, even if you have just a small amount of urine in the bladder. And sometimes those contractions get so strong that nothing can hold the urine back and the urine just comes out. It usually comes with a feeling of urge to go, that you really need to go to the bathroom. And the classic presentation is someone who like, I really need to go, I run to the bathroom and I can't make it. And another type of incontinence, stress urinary incontinence, not because it's stressful emotionally, even though it is, but it happens because of the increased abdominal pressure. So those two muscles, right, the pelvic floor muscles, just so weak, they can't keep the urethra closed. So anything that puts extra pressure on our stomach, like coughing, laughing, sneezing, doing sit-ups, will make urine come out. So because this is two different conditions, we treat them differently. So for the urinary leakage associated with urgency, we can do behavior modifications. For example, it's very popular right now to drink a lot of water. Like everyone, whoever you ask, they're like, oh, I'm not drinking enough. I need to drink more. But everyone forgets the more you drink, the more you pee. So if you always, your bladder is always full, you're always going to have that sense of urgency. And at some point you might get very full that even if your like pelvic floor muscles are great, trying to hold it back, like those detrusor muscles will expel the urine. So this is a good place to start. But then there are medications that can relax those bladder muscles and prevent urine from coming out. It doesn't mean that you never can pee again, but it just will buy you some time between like you feeling like, oh, I need to go to actually pee. Similar effect has Botox. So when we inject Botox in the bladder wall, it does exactly the same to those muscles as when we inject Botox in our face. It relaxes the muscles. And the good thing about Botox is that it works locally. So you don't have to take oral medications that do have some side effects. And you just need to see your provider 2-3 times a year and you're good. There is also neuromodulation, which means retraining of the bladder nerves. And it can be done through the acupuncture, the needle that we place around the ankle where the peripheral branches of the nerves that are innervating the bladder pass through. And we attach the current to that needle and stimulate those nerves. There is also treatment where we put a bladder pacemaker, similar to the heart pacemaker. We can insert the bladder pacemaker that's going to stimulate those nerves and that helps with urinary urgency, urinary urge incontinence and also help women who has a fecal incontinence, which sometimes those conditions go hand in hand. So this is about the urgency related urinary incontinence.
One follow-up question. So all of those sound, I don't want to say invasive, but like certainly not easy treatments. Like even the behavioral modification, right? It is, and just to clarify, you're not telling people like everyone needs to drink less water, right? But probably a component of the behavioral modification is like, don't maybe, you know, minimize or decrease the total amount and only drink what you really need physiologically. But overall, like every treatment that you discussed, I was like cringing a little bit, just thinking like probably not the most pleasant thing to undergo. So From a benefit standpoint, how helpful are these in actually helping someone with incontinence?
Yeah. Well, you know, the problem with urinary urge incontinence that you can't take the control over that. So if you have a leakage with physical activity, women can like avoid physical activity. But when it's urge related, it's very unpredictable. And I see in a lot of women who stop going out because they like not sure when it happens, stop wearing what they want, and they buy like all these pads and pull-ups and diapers, spend so much money, it's so expensive, because they're scared of like how invasive the treatment sounds. And then they so totally surprised how actually like easy and simple those treatments are in practice. And it changes their life completely. Botox will take you, what, half an hour visit to the doctor? The procedure itself is 2 minutes, and it's just like the numbing component and all of that. And you're done. And you do that for like your face, or you go for other like maintenance treatments. And getting your bladder under control changes life significantly. And I totally get what you're saying. And that's why anytime we have an initial appointment, I spend a lot of time talking about each treatment and how if one doesn't work, we can always try another one. And for some people, they're so sick and tired of this issue that they just want to like give me the most definitive one. And the most definitive one would be Botox or a neuromodulation. Obviously, there is some personal variation on a case-by-case basis, which one would work better for a particular patient. But that's like the most effective and the most durable ones.
So those were all stress incontinence.
This is all urge incontinence.
I'm sorry. So now let's talk stress incontinence, which is that one. Yeah. Which one is more common?
You know, both of them are very common. Yes. So again, if you think about it, one in three women who deliver vaginally will develop like urinary incontinence, period. The large percentage of American women suffer with this condition. So stress urinary incontinence happens when we can't can't keep our urethra closed. So any increase in abdominal pressure will prompt the urine to come out. So the classic presentation, women can't cough or sneeze, or whenever they go on a hike or trying to exercise, some urine comes out.
I feel like the commercials for this always involve somebody jumping on a trampoline. I don't know how many people of childbearing age are going at trampolines routinely, but I think that's like the example people think of, right? It's like, you can't jump on a trampoline without peeing yourself.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. So what can be done for that? In some minor cases, meaning like you just lose like a couple of drops of urine, pelvic floor physical therapy can help to kind of retrain those muscles. The only downside is that if it happens to the women who had a multiple vaginal birth, the muscles and ligaments might be so damaged that you just can't retrain the tissue that's already kind of abnormal, not as it used to be. But it's definitely an option for someone who wanna like try this conservative option. There is also a pessary. Pessary is a special device made out of medical grade silicone that you put in the vagina, and the pessary can be used for pelvic organ prolapse and for urinary incontinence. And the pessary for urinary incontinence has this special knob, and the function of that knob is to compress the urethra. So anytime you have increase in your abdominal pressure, your urethra actually compressed, so urine can come out. It's not the perfect treatment, but it can help women who, let's say, only having leaks when they go for like intensive run. So they can insert that pessary and enjoy the leak-free run. And for women who, let's say, who is younger, who still want to have more kids, or who is not ready to have a surgery, that could be an option. The next option is urethral bulking agent. And what it means, it's basically like fillers for the urethra that occupy that space, and it prevents urine from coming out. And the next gold standard treatment is urethral sling, the piece of synthetic material that we put under the urethra that supports the urethra and doesn't let it open up whenever you have a increase in abdominal pressure.
So we keep mentioning like vaginal delivery as being like very, very closely linked to this. And something that you said earlier that I keep thinking about is every woman, right? I think you said this, like every woman after vaginal delivery should have pelvic floor PT. So I think that is generally, that sounds amazing, right? But I think like realistically, at least in the United States, which is the only healthcare sort of system I'm familiar with because I work and practice here, is that that's not like a standard, right? I don't think OBs like send for PT as like a standard thing at the follow-up visit after deliveries. Is that something that should change?
Well, I think it should change. And if you think about it, whenever somebody has an injury somewhere in the body, they're being sent to physical therapy. Vaginal birth is significant trauma and injury. Like your pelvic floor muscles are shocked. And so I think it's definitely very important to help with healing to go to pelvic floor physical therapy. But it's not only with vaginal birth. It's also true for cesarean birth because you're cutting through your abdominal muscles and you can't use your abdominal muscles for some time after birth as well. So your pelvic floor start compensating. And it's also very important to start going to someone who can like massage those muscles, who can help with that. And I totally understand that it's very difficult to get to a good pelvic floor PT like using insurance. So here in Los Angeles, I think it's almost impossible. But I can assure you that if you go to pelvic floor PT and spend that money, that would be like the best money you have spent.
Well, because it'll
Someone.
probably save you also time and money later on, because the idea, right, is that you're trying to prevent all these issues from developing incontinence and so on, because the treatments that you mentioned, right, they're invasive. I'm sure they're not necessarily cheap. And so it makes sense to me to invest that time and money as a preventative measure with PT.
Absolutely. And I think ideally it should be part of this like recovery, taking care of the mother. And now it's your time to go to pelvic floor physical therapy because that's the area that worked a lot during pregnancy, carrying the baby, and after, like during delivery and after.
I think that could probably be a whole nother conversation because I think, right, there's this I think are not well established idea that in the US we don't necessarily do a great job of supporting postpartum care for the mom. And certainly, for having all these ancillary services like PT and things like that should be standard, but unfortunately are not yet.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I want to ask one more type of sort of incontinence related question, which maybe isn't necessarily trauma related, but certainly one that I think I've heard a little bit about, and certainly more frequently. I've heard about it more in the recent weeks or months. I'm really not sure why, but interstitial cystitis. So this is, right, it's a separate category. It's not like incontinence or trauma related necessarily. Is that something that you see?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, interstitial cystitis is basically, we call it angry bladder syndrome. There are multiple theories on how we like how women do, like or men develop interstitial cystitis. But the idea is that the internal lining of the bladder gets damaged, so it becomes more sensitive. So and people can have a different symptoms, anything from or anytime I drink coffee or drink anything acidic or eat pasta with tomato sauce, my bladder hurts. Some people very sensitive to stress. Some people might be related to the hormonal changes. So there is a lot of phenotypes of the interstitial cystitis, and incontinence usually not the most prevalent presenting symptoms. People feel like, oh, they need to go to the bathroom all the time. And they do, like every 15 minutes, 30 minutes, they just feel like they need to pee because the bladder is so uncomfortable.
But is the bladder full? Like the bladder doesn't fill up that frequently. So what happens when they go? It's just little volume?
It's basically the urine that's in there irritates the bladder lining. So for example, one of the treatments is to do bladder installations that you install lidocaine, steroids to kind of help coat the internal lining of the bladder. Or another type of treatment is hydrodescension, where it's done usually under anesthesia because it's painful. You manually distend the bladder with the goal to disrupt those abnormal nerve endings to help heal and improve the pain. Sometimes people who have interstitial cystitis, they might have like ulcers in the bladder. So it's also helpful to coagulate those ulcers, to remove those ulcers, so to help with healing.
Interesting. We covered a lot today. We focused, I don't know why we ended up focusing so much on incontinence. I just think it's probably so relevant and so common, especially in the Jewish female population. What are maybe myths or misconceptions that you come across a lot that people have about female pelvic health?
Well, one that I mentioned before, that you should do Kegels all the time. It's not true. You should get evaluated and see if the Kegels are right for you.
Are they ever right for anyone?
Yes, absolutely. Some people can have like a weakness of the pelvic floor and Kegels will help. Or some people who might go to the bathroom so frequently and have urinary leaks, you can just do 2-3 Kegels when you have that like urgency, and it can buy you some time to get to the bathroom. Another common myth is that peeing yourself is a normal process of aging. It's kind of, sometimes patients tell me, oh, you know, my grandma, she peed herself, my mom peed herself, and I'm peeing myself now, it's my turn now. Which is, I mean, I'm glad that you guys talk about it in your family because it's important. But at the same time, it's not something that you have to deal with. And I think right now I see that even younger women become more aware of their pelvic floor, and they don't want to live with that. And they want to address this condition earlier, which is totally fine and normal. Yeah, I think that's about the pelvic floor.
So one last final question. I like to ask this to every specialist that I have on. The origins of this podcast is preventative health. So in your specialty, is there any, maybe like one or two like pearls of prevention that you wish people knew?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, like you can't modify factors. Like you can't modify your genetic. You want to have babies. Like what can you do about it? But you can make sure that you maintain your bowel habits, like a healthy bowel habits, that you having bowel movements daily, that you're not straining. If you sit on a toilet and it's going nowhere, get up. Don't spend too much time in a toilet. Also, pelvic floor physical therapy after vaginal or cesarean birth, very important. And also, again, because we're the women carrying stress on our pelvic floor, if you feel like, you know, sex hurting, something doesn't feel right, it's always good to go to pelvic floor physical therapy, because they might evaluate you and help you just rehabilitate your pelvic floor. Also, hormones are important, I think, to keep in mind. For example, women who are breastfeeding, they deprived an estrogen, and they might develop vaginal dryness, vaginal pain, and that will affect pelvic floor muscles as well. So it's totally normal to take a vaginal estrogen topically, even if you're breastfeeding. And also postmenopausal or perimenopausal women, They also estrogen depleted and testosterone depleted. So using vaginal estrogen in perimenopause, menopause, it's the best maintenance that you can do for your vagina, for your bladder, for your pelvic floor.
So fascinating. I feel like you have such a unique perspective because you see women through like all stages, right? You see them before they necessarily intend to get pregnant or have babies, maybe direct, like right immediately after if they're having issues, and then like into peri and post menopause. So such an interesting specialty, and so cool what you do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Tate.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on the podcast and talking about this. I feel like we probably need a part two of this to talk a little bit more about like your specialty. I know you do a lot in sexual health, and that's probably worth a whole nother podcast.
I would happily come again and talk about female sexual health.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the JOMA podcast. We welcome your feedback and ideas for future episodes. Send us an email at health@joma.org. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform.